Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're talking about the unusual circumstance of communities actually getting redress for land violently taken from them by previous governments in Guinea. And African cities are growing at a phenomenal rate. By the year 2035, we'll have six cities with populations of 10 million or more. One of them may be in your country. Rapid urbanization is one of the factors propelling this growth. But is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Rapid urbanization can be beneficial if the advantages are harnessed. For instance, in Uganda, 60% of the GDP is generated from Kampala City alone. And so with that increase in population comes better economic opportunities. If well harnessed, then you would have improvement in the quality of life of the citizens.
It's Wednesday, the 18th of September. First, we go to Accra. Ghana has achieved that rare thing in West Africa. Since 1992, multi-party elections and the peaceful transfer of power. It has been touch and go a couple of times since then, to be honest, but Ghanaians managed to keep it together. But now, the biggest opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, alleges that there are irregularities in the compilation of the voters' roll. Elections are due in December, so everyone's getting a bit jumpy about the seeming unauthorized transfer of voters to unspecified districts, the removal of names from the roll, and so on. The NDC says this is unprecedented, and they are asking the Electoral Commission to investigate the issue. And they've called on their supporters to demonstrate in support of this particular demand.
So if registration equipment have been stolen, and then you see people who have been transferred, and you cannot trace where they were transferred from, the conclusion can be obvious. Another layer is that over 3,000 people have their names deleted completely from the register.
They should sit up and then do what is good for the country. That's for all that we want.
The National Democratic Congress want the Electoral Commission to open up the process of auditing the voters' roll to all interested parties. The Commission says the NDC's call is misguided. But why won't the Commission allow a forensic audit? I've been finding out from Franklin Kujo, founding president and CEO of Imani Center for Policy and Education, which is a think tank based in Accra. So, Franklin, what is the issue with the voter register?
Well, you know, the Ghana's voters register has always had issues. Anytime we have elections, a number of issues that come up. But specifically on this one, the NDC managed to, the opposition party, the largest opposition party, managed to find out that there have been multiple errors in registration of voters. Voters have been transferred to other places that they're not aware of. And another errors that come up, a million people who may have had their registration affected. So clearly, there are multiple errors, but essentially, it is about the fact that some voters have been transferred unknowingly to other places, and indeed others cannot find their names at all.
Is the implication that this is being done deliberately, or are they genuinely errors?
Well, if you listen to the EC, the EC Electoral Commission actually confessed that a few of the officials have actually engaged in voter transfers without the authorities, the commission's approval. So there's some aspect that people want to believe that is deliberate. The problem with the EC is that while it accepts some of the errors, at least three of the errors the NDC has pointed so far, it is unwilling to do anything about it. In fact, it claims that the errors are misguided and that the call for an audit is actually misguided and premature. But the scale of the errors are quite frightening. And that's why the whole country is actually quite worried right now.
Why are they digging their heels in if 250,000 people are sort of erroneously moved around or removed from the voters' roll? Surely they must see that this is a problem for people and it raises tensions unnecessarily. Is there no way of compelling them to do it?
Well, ordinarily, the EC should have been speaking to the parties, but the EC has created this atmosphere of essentially not listening to any alternative voices at all. And so it's very difficult. We are hoping that Parliament will be recalled from recess, and then maybe the matter will be determined thereon. But clearly speaking, but I'm worried that the scale of the errors may actually be more than we are dealing with right now. And I suspect that's the reason why the EC is being reticent and listening to good reason. And many independents, by the way, not just me, respected independents and academics have called on the EC, Electoral Commission, to accept an audit. And people are not even asking for an external audit. All they are saying is that, well, the EC puts up its IT officials, and then the various parties as well bring their IT officials, and they go through painstakingly, go through the register and correct the errors. Because the EC has accepted that at least 3 out of 6 of the errors identified by the largest opposition are actually true.
How credible has the EC been up to now?
Well, you may be asking the wrong person, because this EC in 2020 told my constituents, and I come from some part of the region, Ghana, called SAR. My people were worried that we were not going to be allowed to vote in the parliamentary elections. I sent them to the chiefs, my chiefs and some elders, I sent them to the electoral commissioner. She received them and later assured me that our people were going to vote for their MP in the elections. 5 days later, she sent a letter midnight saying that my people could not vote in the elections. And since 2020, we've never had representation in parliament at all. So if you're asking someone who really about credibility, I have lived it. And frankly speaking, I may be probably be the wrong person, but the judgment, the juries are out there. Many people do not trust the EC. In fact, the Afrobarometer survey, which is run by another think tank called the Center for Democratic Development in Ghana, has consistently shown that the results consistently shown that the EC is less trusted. In fact, they've moved from a high of about 67% about 6 years or 8 years ago to about 33% as we speak. So it's not just me, but many people really do not trust the EC.
The EC said that the call for a forensic audit was misguided, and you said that earlier, and they say that the Commission strongly believes that the surest way to attaining a robust and credible register is not through demonstrations. But so what are they suggesting then is the surest way of attaining a robust and credible register?
Well, in the EC's lexicon, the robust way is to exhibit the register for people to go and find out about these multiple errors. But the challenge here is that, I mean, there are many thousands of people who may find out quite late in the day about this error. So I don't think they're addressing the issue head on at all. And I think, clearly speaking, the surest way to get them to act is through mass demonstrations. And I hope that Parliament is recalled from recess so that this matter will be determined once and for all.
So tell us about the major players and parties. President Nana Akufo-Addo won't be standing again, right? Because he's exhausted his 2 terms.
Yes, he wouldn't be standing. His vice president has been actually nominated as the flag bearer of the party right now, Dr. Mahmoud Bahoumia Etaisiri. And the opposition leader who will be contesting is former President John Mahama. Those are the leading candidates. And of course, there's a third candidate who defected from the ruling party, Alan Chairmantin, who used to be the trade minister in Nana Akufo-Addo's government.
So where did he defect to? Is he an independent?
Well, he formed his own movement called the Movement for Change, with the butterfly as its emblem.
Okay.
And, yeah.
So Dr. Bahoumia has incumbency to deal with. Former President John Dramani Mahama has a record that he will have to defend now, given that he lost 8 years ago to Nana Akufo-Addo. What do they have to say for themselves then?
Well, they've been comparing records. The vice president has dared the former president to compare records, and he says that he's managed to achieve 33 things, at least as vice president. The challenge with that narrative, though, is that part of his narrative suggests that for some of the many ills in the current government, he didn't have constitutional authority to deal with them, especially the economic decadence that we've experienced over the last 8 years. He doesn't want to accept responsibility for that. But there are certain things he says that he's able to achieve, and he's achieved 33 of them, and then says he alone actually initiated that. But for those that are negative, he had no constitutional authority. There's some sort of counterintuitive, really. The former president then comes and says, well, I left you with an economy that was quite doing well. I mean, the dollar to the cedi was around 4 cedis to a dollar. Today, as we speak, it's nearing 16 cedis, right? Inflation at the point went to 54%, I think, 2 years ago. Never did inflation go to that level under the former president. And there are many economic factors. Unemployment itself has gone that high. And so the former president says, well, look, I built so much infrastructure within 4 years as president, compared with how much you have received, so much money. You drove the country into a debt iceberg and virtually into a junk status, and then in an IMF program, as I speak. So clearly the collections look set to be falling on the economy.
Now, Ghana has largely, for this century, certainly had peaceful transfers of power. There were a couple of times when it got very sticky and it got a bit scary. This election register issue, can it endanger that sense of security that Ghanaians have inculcated in the democratic process?
Oh, without a doubt, it definitely can. And, you know, we've had issues in the past with registers. We never got this close to having a whole, should I call it, opposition party organizing elections in almost every region. And they are threatening to do so in every district if the EC doesn't budge. And this time around, there are many, many people, independents, who are actually now calling on the EC. I suspect if the EC does not act, there could be trouble.
That's Franklin Cudjoe, the CEO of the Imani Center for Policy and Education in Accra. Now to Guinea, and a situation many communities across the continent often find themselves in. They have their land taken from them, often with violence, and no hope of redress or compensation. This happened most recently to people living in Kaporo Rails, Kipetu, Dimes, and Dar es Salaam. All these are neighborhoods in Conakry, the capital. These people have had their land taken away from them by the government of the then President Alpha Conde in 2019. Others were dispossessed in 1998. But things are different this time. Thousands of people forced off their land over several decades can now have their land back. This decision follows decades of struggle for justice and compensation, highlighted in a Human Rights Watch report that uncovered severe legal and humanitarian violations related to the evictions. We'll be hearing from a member of the community in a moment, but let's first listen to Jim Wormington, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch and one of the authors of the report. He shared the findings with me in our conversation.
This was from research that we conducted in 2019 in Conakry, the capital of Guinea, in an area particularly called Kaporo Rai, which was really an area that looked like other neighborhoods of Conakry. There were multi-story buildings, there were families, extended families living in houses. And then very suddenly, over the course of a few days, bulldozers came into that neighborhood and destroyed the entire area. So I remember I used to drive past the area a lot when I was in Conakry. And then when I came back to do the actual research about the evictions, it looked like a bomb had exploded. There was debris everywhere. There were flattened buildings over the entire area. And nobody was really left except for a few people who were picking through the belongings that were left there and a few young men who were sleeping around a campfire in the few shelters that they could find. So it was an absolutely devastating event for these families that were involved.
And now they're getting their land back.
Yes. I mean, I think that what they had been asking for at the time of the report that we wrote was, first of all, for the evictions to stop, because this was in an area of land that was being developed for business, according to the Ghanaian government. And the people who were living there, for them, this was not an area for business. This was an area that had been the home for their families for many, many years. And so the consistent demand that they had back then was for the evictions to stop. I think in the years that have followed, they have been campaigning relentlessly for justice. And that's, we've seen a transition from the government of Alpha Conde, who was in power when the evictions happened, to the military government. And so that campaigning, which has gone on for years, has also included filing and succeeding in a lawsuit against the Conde government's actions at the regional ECOWAS court, so the West African Court of Justice. And that campaigning has obviously helped them meet up until today.
There was another destruction of people's homes and properties in 1998, and then, of course, the 2019 one. But what were the reasons behind this? Was it just gentrification or making way for development without consultation, without consideration for people? Or was there something more behind it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So from the government's perspective at the time, they were saying that this was land that they needed to develop Conakry. Conakry is a peninsula city. A lot of the business and administration is concentrated at one end of the peninsula. So they were saying that they needed to open up other areas of land to business. But the reality was, for these families that had been living there for so long, the process that the government should follow if they are going through a development process was far from what was followed. So according to human rights standards and human rights laws, if you're going to evict families for the purposes of development, you need to have extensive consultation with those families. You need to have courts that give you the right to take that land. You need to make sure they have other places to go and they have notice and really have the chance to leave the land to somewhere comfortable before the evictions. So really, it should be a last resort and with a lot of safeguards. None of those things in this case had happened. There were nowhere for people to go. They had had really short notice, essentially a very violent process of evictions. And then for many years, the land was just left dormant, undeveloped. So from the family's perspective, this was something that was far from the safeguards that you would expect.
So is this an ongoing process of the government now to address these previous and grievous damages to communities concerning land grabs and so on? Is this a concerted policy of theirs, or are these one-offs?
Yeah, I think that would be a question also to ask the victims involved. I think that certainly, for example, I do a lot of work in the mining sector in Guinea, and there's still a lot of challenges with access to land for communities that has been taken for mining.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jim Wilmington, Senior Researcher at Human Rights Watch. Now let's hear from Samba Sow, the spokesperson for the victims. He began by telling us how people feel about the government's decision to return their land.
I would say that the victims are extremely satisfied. They were overcome with emotion. We saw photos of elderly people in tears who did not expect these reparations, because Guinea has a history marked by state violence, political violence against its own populations, and the problems are either pending before Guinean courts, which are known for their slowness, and then sometimes they're forgotten. It is very rare in Guinea that the state can recognize the errors of the past, and this is what has just been done. We salute this act, and all the victims today are truly satisfied.
We wondered whether the victims had any concerns about the process.
No, there is no doubt. It's a long process that began after the coup d'etat against Alpha Conde, who was nevertheless one of the architects of the destruction of our neighborhood. A week or less than a week after the coup, we asked the government, President Doumbouya, to look into our case. Afterwards, we were invited to participate in the national meetings, which brought together a good part of the country's elite and different components of Guinean society. We explained all our problems, and then afterwards the state came to us to carry out a census of the different families. That's 2,673 families who were identified with their property through a Senegalese firm, which used satellite images of the neighbourhood before its destruction to allow each family to identify their house. So people have complete confidence because the president was not obliged to do so, especially in the country's context. Alpha Conde had promised to bring justice to the victims of 1998. He said in 2016 that the state was wrong and that this problem needed to be resolved. But unfortunately, 3 years later, the same Alpha Conde sent through his government machines that destroyed the rest of our homes.
Samba did say they worry that the process of organizing and distributing the compensation they've been waiting for might take a long time.
No, the money has not yet been provided. The amount has not yet been defined. But there are plans to create a commission made up of various state services, but also of victims, to reflect together on the terms and conditions of financial compensation.
And that was Samba Sow in Guinea. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.
We know that Africa's population is growing at a rapid rate and that large numbers of people are moving from rural to urban areas in search of economic opportunities. This means that cities have to expand to cope with this massive influx. They have to provide jobs, housing and schools and health infrastructure. According to an Economist Intelligence Unit report, six African cities will have more than 10 million people by 2035. Cities like Luanda and Dar es Salaam will join others like Cairo, Kinshasa and Joburg with populations of more than 10 million people. On top of that, 17 other urban areas will have more than 5 million people. Addis Ababa, Kampala and Abidjan appear to be growing the fastest, nearly 10% per annum. So by 2035, more than half of all Africans will be living in urban areas. This presents challenges and opportunities. And what are they? Fiona Nshemerirwe is in Kampala and Mateus Spaliviero is in Abidjan. They are both urban development experts from UN Habitat. And there are many of the answers that we seek.
So, Mateus, what is driving rapid urbanization in those cities, do you think?
What is producing rapid urbanization is the fact that people are moving from rural to urban areas, but there are three main factors determining migration right now. The socioeconomic factor, which is the one we know, but now in addition there is the climate impact and the conflict as well. In an urbanization, then it is not just caused from people influxing into cities, is also caused by the natural growth of cities. So of people already living in cities that are just, the population is naturally increasing. So it's the combination of the two that is determining rapid urbanization. And in Africa is a bit out of control right now in most of the countries.
And why is that?
The demographics, first of all. So there is a demographic growth that is much higher than the other continents. That determines a very high youth population. The youth maybe do not have the same behavior as their parents, working more in the rural areas or on rural-related work. So they prefer to seek for a job and better opportunities in terms of access of services and so on in cities. And so this is causing a very high level of urbanization. We have cities in Africa, mainly in West Africa, but not only growing more than 5% per year, which is completely unmanageable for any city in the world, actually.
So, Fiona, is rapid urbanization always a problematic process, or can it also be a beneficial process?
Rapid urbanization can be beneficial if the advantages are harnessed. For instance, with population growth comes an increase in the labor availability that would really improve the economic growth of a city. For instance, in Uganda, 60% of the GDP is generated from Kampala city alone. And so with that increase in population comes better economic opportunities. If well harnessed, say if it is planned and well harnessed, then you would have improvement in the quality of life of the citizens. It has its advantages.
And what are the disadvantages?
The disadvantages are if it is unplanned. Rapid urbanization moves faster than the ability for planning for the increased population growth. So this is where the disadvantage lies, because you will have urban sprawl, unplanned settlements such as slums. You will have poor connectivity and eventually a high unemployment rate.
Mateus, so are there cities right now on the continent that are actually managing the process of rapid urbanization well?
Personally, from my experience, I think the majority of the cities are overwhelmed with the speed of growth of urban areas. I agree with Fiona. Of course, the theory says that if a city is properly planned and managed, that we can harness the benefits of urbanization. At the same time, the reality shows that currently, you know, as you improve, for example, informal settlements in one part of the city, they are more appearing in other parts of the city. And I think one of the solutions lies on not just focusing on mega cities and big cities, but on a system, what we call a system of cities, meaning that we need to look at secondary and tertiary cities in a national territory so that the population are attracted by different alternatives, and then cities will be able to manage better the fast urbanization rate.
Fiona, I'm going to ask you the same question.
I wouldn't say that they are managing rapid urbanization, but I've seen cities that are actually making an effort, such as Addis Ababa recently hosted the Africa Urban Forum. And you could clearly see that the city is making an effort through improved transportation systems and providing housing.
Okay, so what are we learning from rapid urbanization? What do we actually need to do? Matthias, you started answering that question. Can you expand a little bit?
Yes, what we have to learn is how to manage urban areas, which is not the same as managing rural areas, because you have more density of assets and infrastructure. So it requires more coordination and more generalists, I mean, meaning experts that are able to understand different fields at the same time, not specialists. So you need to have really strong technical capacities at the local level, at the level of municipalities and city governments. Secondly, is that countries need to have proper national territorial development plans, meaning that they need to consider the whole territory of their country and plan for it, meaning understanding where are development corridors located, where are areas of growth, and how to promote a policy of investment which is diversified, avoiding investing everything in the same city. There is also awareness raising at the local level with the communities, the way they settled, and the way they can also improve in terms of basic and social services management and so on.
So Fiona, would you say that there is the political sense of urgency and political will about how African countries can actually harness the benefits of a very young population, for instance, that is coming in with this very young energy to expand cities? Is the plan there? Are there plans afoot to actually make, to turn rapid urbanization into a positive for the continent?
I think there is evidence of political will and political awareness of the need to deal with the urbanization issue in Africa. And this was evidenced at the recently concluded the Africa Urban Forum, where we saw ministers and different political figures coming together to derive African solutions to the urbanization challenges. We have finally come to the realization that the future is urban and there is no turning back, especially the fact that we have a huge youth population. Like Uganda has more than 70% of its population under 30.
Matthias, would you like to add anything?
Urbanization is happening at a very fast rate. We always talk about percentages of population, but if we look into absolute numbers, the urban population is going to double in the next 25 years and to triple just after that. So it's like an exponential growth. And so there is need for coordination and collaboration and partnerships.
Matthias Paliviero and Fiona Nchemerirwe, urban development experts from UN Habitat. Focus on Africa was put together by Sunita Nahar, Bella Hassan, Yvette Wagiramaria, Kane Pieri, and Nyasha Michelle here in London. Nick Randell was our technical producer. Paul Bajibinga was our senior journalist. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thank you for listening.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream, in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.